Patrick Smalley is the editor and co-founder of Business Desk and has reported on the New Zealand economy and business since the 80s. Hello, Patrick.
Hi, Catherine. And of course, Business Desk signed with Google about 6 months ago. We just wish everyone else would hurry up.
Oh, remind us of the context, please. How it happened.
Simply that Google has this thing called Google News Showcase, which is a it's a showcase for a part of our daily content output, which they pay us for and put onto their various platforms in a way which should drive traffic for us. I guess we're probably a bit of a disappointment to those in the industry who would have liked to have done a joint negotiation, but we just couldn't see the point. We could see that what they were offering was, from our perspective, a almost transformational sum of money, and just got on with it.
Would it be transformational? Would it be transformational for some of the bigger players like, the Herald and its allied groups, NZME, beg your pardon?
Yes.
Was there anything to do with your size that meant this worked for you and not for them?
I think that it probably, what I have to assume is that the arrangements now signed also by NZME are of a similar scale. They may not be transformational in quite the same way because NZME is already a profitable company. For us, it was clearly, as prior to our sale to NZME, it was clearly a significant additional source of cash flow of a kind that was otherwise largely unseen from the domestic market. So
you have had a lot going on, haven't you?
you could try for a year to negotiate the thing. You have to wait for the Commerce Commission to say it was okay. There was just a sense that at a certain point, sometimes it's better just to get on and do the deal. So those of us who are in, I think Google News Showcase is due to kick off very shortly. Those who haven't yet made an arrangement and are perhaps looking to jointly negotiate could be some months away, and I guess being the gimlet-eyed capitalist that I am, I'd rather see the money earlier than later, and we didn't feel that with Google anyway that we were being messed around. We were just being offered what looked like a pretty good deal.
So Stuff and Others still out there, are they? However, Patrick, does this set a baseline in some ways? Like, are you able to ramp up what you charge over time?
Yes.
Okay.
In fact, I think if that's the baseline, then it's a pretty good baseline. And obviously, I can't discuss the commercial terms, but Meta's another matter. Meta/Facebook has quite a different approach. This is an investment by Google in their social license to operate as much as it is a desire to see New Zealand news media companies do well. Meta/Facebook is much more inclined to take a purely commercial approach, and you see this throughout the two organizations. Google makes a real effort to try to get alongside the governments and the countries that it operates in. Meta has a much more take it or leave it approach.
This raises one more interesting issue, which is the way that the content is used, of course. And do you decide, there's a proportion supplied, do you decide what is supplied and how it is used, or do you end up control of that?
I believe that we have control of it. It starts fairly shortly, and I haven't checked those details, but it's a proportion of what we produce. It's only a small proportion. It's a very useful way to expand our brand reach and for Google to have additional content. It works for all parties.
Interesting. All right. Now, to your first theme today, which is where have all the workers gone? Everywhere you look, there are signs up. Hospitality, accommodation, just go on and on and on. Retail, that's the ones you can see because, you walk past them. This chronic worker shortage, closed borders, and perhaps that has indicated our heavy reliance on immigrant labour. Closed borders, obviously, a big factor. What's happening now? What are you hearing out there?
Well, I think there's a bunch of factors at play all at once. For a start, New Zealanders are leaving and have begun leaving in larger numbers than they were able to during COVID. That's been happening for a few months. And you can see from the from stats which show where employment growth is happening across the workforce that there's reduced workforce growth amongst 25 to 29 year olds. And while it may not be quite the same impulse for OE as there used to be back 20 years ago, there is definitely a pent up demand amongst people of about that age group to get out of New Zealand for a year or two and get that international experience and to live overseas. And that's ramped up a bit now. The borders not only are open out into the world, but also that it's possible to get back home, which is, it's a big constraining factor. The thought that if you needed to return home, you're going to have to do MIQ and so forth. So that's one factor. As you say, migration settings are very tight. I think the government is determined to try to use the fact that borders have been closed and the labour market is tight to improve wages, and to improve the training and investment in productivity enhancing technology that always tends to elude New Zealand businesses. So I think one of the things that's kind of going to be interesting about this is how much of the shortfall will be met over say the medium term by better trained workers, and how much it will be met by, say, automation. So I think of an issue like the clear, widespread mistreatment of RSE workers picking fruit. That's probably not a sustainable employment model, the way, particularly for those who are being basically living in awful conditions and under conditions which may not be, in fact, be consistent with New Zealand employment law. But at the same time, the kiwifruit industry, for example, is already investing heavily in automated picking because it simply can't get enough people to pick the fruit. So I think you'll see automation coming into play as well. And that is a productivity enhancement, even if it doesn't mean people get jobs out of it. I think the other thing that's happening is that the sense that we're short of people is really exacerbated by the number of people who are taking sick leave at the moment. We have had a dreadful winter, and every time somebody in, a place where there are maybe five people living contracts COVID, all the other people who have to isolate has a flow-on effect. You can work from home, but for those who are still turning up to the office or who can't work from home, it exacerbates that sense that we're short. And to the extent that they can, I think some employers, particularly those who have frontline staff, are over-hiring in order to make sure that they have actually got the people to be able to keep their businesses ticking over, because what the business confidence and other surveys are showing is that probably the biggest factor stopping companies growing at the moment is not fear of recession, it's inability to get staff to expand production, which is it's the oddest recessionary conditions I've ever seen, where basically it's really hard to find people to hire. And where the main constraint is not economic conditions so much as inability to find those people.
One of the bank economists, whose name I'm going to forget, made exactly this point, that you actually need a higher level of unemployment, perhaps around 4.5%, in order to have the conditions to ease inflation. And that's one side of the equation, which is excess demand over supply, right? The other side, as you say, is the impact on production. It's just a strange situation we are in with the particular nature of constraints on what has otherwise been an overheated economy. It's just it is a bizarre combination.
Well, in a way, the lack of available workers is a flip side to the existence of rampant inflation. This is what we're seeing at the moment was always to some degree predictable, which was that when governments spent billions and billions of dollars propping up their economies through COVID by inventing money and pushing it into those economies to save jobs and save businesses. And when central banks all over the world cut interest rates to phenomenally low levels, historically low levels, sometimes below zero, that was always, we've ended up with a huge number of people in work and too much money chasing too few goods, that gives you inflation, and too much money chasing too few people, which is giving you, which reflects worker shortages, but also is reflected in significant wage growth, which on one hand is great. Average wage growth is around 7% in the last year, so actually wages are keeping pace with this level of inflation. But ultimately, there are probably a lot of people going into the workforce who, try to put it another way. If you look at who's getting work at the moment, the biggest increase is in people 15 to 19 years old. So that is basically school leavers going into work rather than going into training or higher education. If those people would start to come back out of the workforce and go to polytech, go to university, get higher qualifications, and if that were to somewhat contribute to a slightly higher rate of inflation as unemployment, I don't know that that would be a terribly bad thing, in the sense that 15 or 16 year old going into work with no significant qualifications is probably not improving their life prospects hugely compared to if they got some more training.
It's a really interesting circumstance, as you say, to be fending off a recession, but to be fending off a recession with very low unemployment accompanying it. These are the particular and peculiar conditions that we find ourselves in. A couple of observations. You've mentioned the productivity and the technology improvements, and this was a stated aim of the Labor government, actually, which was to manage immigration settings in a way that would effectively push that investment in technology. How appropriate is it coming out of the times that we are in? I can tell you now, still talking personally to employer after employer, going through the process of trying to become registered employers for the first time for immigration purposes because they can't find enough local staff, and that's a heck of a performance and costly and everything else. How appropriate to keep the pressure on for that kind of investment by keeping a tight rein on immigration?
I think if the immigration policy setting were a great deal more nuanced than it currently is, in theory, that might be fine. I think that two things are happening at the moment, one economic and one political. The economic thing is basically that the systems that are being created to allow people to apply to bring people in are cumbersome, long-winded, and I've heard them described as hostile, despite the government believing that they've created a much more conducive environment for certain types of either areas of skills need or specialist skills that we can't find locally. The reality for most employers that I speak to seems to be that they just can't find those, that the immigration process is too clunky and has lots of steps in it, all of which take time and money, and it's sort of we're from the government and we're here to help kind of thing. So in that sense, you're getting a political reaction as well amongst employers, which is basically that I think the government's lost the room on immigration policy as far as employers and business owners are concerned, because they just don't feel that the government understands how difficult it is out there at the moment. Now, I think that if those employers were to be given carte blanche access to the global labour market tomorrow, they would find that actually it's really difficult anyway. But I think that the way that the government is approaching it means that they're copping more flack than they really need to. I mean, this labour market issue is global. No one can find enough people anywhere at the moment because we're all in the same boat. All big governments which are able to spend lots of money that they plucked out of thin air and cut interest rates in order to help the global economy through COVID. We've got a synchronised economic cycle going on now, where at the moment there's a lot of inflation, very tight labour markets, and efforts by all, including our Reserve Bank, which will put up interest rates again tomorrow, to tame what is basically an overheated global economy.
Another observation is the structure of our commercial sector. Again, small to medium enterprises dominate, and I'm just trying to remember the stats. Is it 95% of businesses of than 20, 80%, whatever?
Yeah.
And how viable is the investment in technology? Obviously, the way we do business online and online retail is one thing, but I don't know, when it comes to hospitality and the restaurants and everything else, I mean, how much can you invest in technology, and how much are many of these small to medium enterprises pretty much going to remain dependent on labour. You can have breakthrough tech. I don't know if you've got a cleaning company of some sort or this or that, any number of breakthrough technologies come in. But in many of our businesses, is it always going to be people that are needed?
I mean, I just think it depends on the sector. A lot of the time, we're always going to need people. There are any number of ways in which new technology can assist. Think of all of these software as a service companies that are out there. Xero, which has made it so easy for people to do their accounts in a tenth of the time that it used to, or booking technologies which gyms and salons and others use, to which are tailored to their needs. When it comes to big capital items, which pieces of machinery which might replace a person or people, that's a bit more difficult for a small or medium enterprise, because generally speaking, they don't have strong enough balance sheets to be able to make a big capital investment like that. And it's a big punt, because it's a new piece of kit, and what if it doesn't work and turns out it needs a lot of maintenance, or underestimated the market or whatever. I mean, there is a bit of a tendency, though, I think, in New Zealand to rely on the idea that lots of small business people with relatively limited commercial skills can just kind of bumble along. When one of the kind of ghastly truths, I guess, of difficult economic times is that those who are able to manage their businesses better will survive, and those who are not, who are doing well in good times, but weren't necessarily doing a great job of running the businesses, will be challenged. And that's productivity comes out of that. I mean, there's a horrible expression for it, creative destruction.
Yes.
But a bit of creative destruction is kind of inevitable in business.
One final observation. It's a question, but it's kind of an observation. It's an interesting one. This is from an emailer. There's a lot of discussion around shortage of employees, with no discussion regarding industry demand for employees. When I grew up, shops were generally closed Saturday afternoon and all of Sunday. Is it possible industry demand for 7-day a week trading is unrealistic? Many shops are closed in Europe for the majority of the weekend. The alternative approach at least needs discussion. It's not just 7 days, is it? It's 24/7, and I haven't kind of done the maths on that as to whether you spread the same amount of work out over the week, or whether you are actually going to require more labour, which might explain why we've become so dependent on immigration, Patrick.
Maybe. Certainly I see a lot of evidence of an anecdotal kind of restaurants, for example, that don't open on a couple of days a week when they would otherwise have been open, or don't open for lunch anymore
because
they can't find enough people.
A lot of that happens.
But in the end, businesses wouldn't open at those hours if there weren't people
demand
going to those businesses to shop. So, the expansion of shop hours, the expansion of working hours is one of the reasons why so many of us are in work. I mean, that's one of the factors here in New Zealand is that we've got about 70% participation rate in the labour market, which is really high by OECD standards and has been for some years. It's not like there's a whole lot of people sitting out there who would quite like to work. There's a lot of people in our labour market, and a very large number of them have got jobs. They may not always be the jobs they love or want, but it's not difficult to find work at the moment.
It's an interesting observation, however, of a societal change that may have impacted demand for labour, exactly the point of the emailer. Now, you mentioned polytechnics. Of course, they're in the situation at the moment, just as you outlined, that when unemployment is low, their enrolments are down. And this has been part of the story of the polytechnic sector, this kind of up-down business and trying to manage enrolments. Part of the solution, apparently, and for other matters as well, was to have been this merger. You've written about and spoken about how badly it's going. We've done interviews also on how badly it's going. A little bit more release yesterday about the plan. It's supposed to be up and running, isn't it, from the end of the year? What did you make of what you saw?
I found it a bit alarming, actually. I mean, I do have a bit of a perfect storm in the polytech sector because of this very high employment amongst younger people who might otherwise be going into training. I mean, recessions are great for creating enrolments. But as I think we've reported previously, the CEO of the last four and a bit years at Te Pukenga, the National Polytechnic merged institution, which they insist is not a mega polytech, but a new way of teaching skills. He went on an unknown amount of leave some weeks ago, and a new operating structure was released yesterday by the acting CEO, who begins this 40 pages or so consultation document with an apology for failing to make more progress and for failing to listen to the sector, and then promptly says that they've got the entire sector has 3 weeks to consult on this new operating model. And that by the end of October, which is really only, what, 2.5 months away, the 14 of the 16 polytechs, which are not yet under the umbrella of Te Pūkenga, will have been integrated into it. So it seems. There's no clarity on jobs from the 1st of January next year. And the Tertiary Education Union, which when I first started writing about this was almost slavishly keen not to criticise the government, is now talking about its membership being incensed by the lack of progress, the over-focus on high-flown strategy documents and frameworks, and not enough actual talking to people.
15% of its staff, they told us, they thought they may have lost already. Some of them, admittedly, at that management level that is being rationalised, but that's what the uncertainty is doing.
Well, this is the worry, isn't it, that in a labour market like the one that we're in, it's not that difficult to find other work. So, and the people who are most skilled and most likely to find other work will be the first out the door, as a rule, unless they're very committed to the idea of training young people in the public education system. So, you know, there's a whole chunk in this document about building a great brand where people want to work, and how much an inspiring place this new Te Pūkenga will be. Well, unfortunately, just rings so hollow by comparison with the nature of the strategic work to date, and to some extent, frankly, to the nature of the document that's been produced. I mean, there is more in this document on equity and inclusion, which are important, than there is on skills acquisition and economic opportunity and what Te Pūkenga is for, which is presumably to give kids or anyone seeking retraining the ability to find a job in a modern economy. That is almost not discussed anywhere. That's why I say I find the document alarming. The overarching goals of the new organisation are couched almost completely in terms of overcoming disadvantage rather than creating opportunity. I would have thought that there's room for both, and that the absence of creation of opportunity is, I don't know if it's a mistake, if it's something which is being dealt with in some other document somewhere, but I'm not left with the sense that this is an organisation that's being created to skilled the next generation of young New Zealanders in a whole variety of industries that need them. It feels more like a sort of a sociological experiment.
Indeed. It's a long way off, it seems, with a few short months to go. Interesting observation here. This might be a topic for another day. This is from someone who works in the IT sector. A part answer to why can't I hire anyone is the hiring techniques in my sector famously desperate for professionals. I'm certain the recruitment service organisations act as faulty gatekeepers. I know of many highly suitable professionals who can't get access because the HR selection systems consistently fail to make appropriate matches. It's a real loss to our national and personal economies. The way recruitment works, that is I'm thinking of pre-COVID, the interviews we've done on the way recruitment works and who the gatekeepers are and what their touchstones are. And now in a post-COVID labour market like this, that is a really interesting observation. Patrick, thanks very much. Patrick Smalley, business commentator.